started up a feminist organization with the name of Fay Beagle. We claim that history is that we have the same kind of context there. And they helped me make sure that people were going to be able to do it. They helped a number of meetings and invited me to be able to do it. During that meeting, usually that lasts for about 1 week, and they are not able to maintain that connection. When I finally did meet the first of these women, who was working on that idea, I got her to address from Germany, actually, in the American community. I'm giving her a dress, but she's really crazy. She's really passionate and good. And I'll say that this is talking to her, but, you know, I'm going to be able to do that. And part of what the interview was part of that. But she spoke about her life and about what they were doing. It comes different than the ones we talked about. For example, they did not just say, you know, define yourself as a feminist. Because to them, feminism is what, actually, in some way, like social media and liberal feminism. These people, women who were struggling to get for women the same rights that men had, and women who were anarchists and immensely critical. Both of the political system and the social and economic system in which they were all rooted, they didn't want the same rights that men had. They didn't think anybody should have or not have those kinds of rights. And so feminism was really work. And that automatically distanced themselves from men and women. They didn't hear why they didn't want to have themselves and how they did on themselves. So I think that's another part of this process, is to be able to work with the same and figure out the next thing. Now, I don't think I understood all the religious character things before I began my field work, but there were things that came clear over time and which are still involving me a little bit, but it's hard to say, more sensible. I want to begin this in a more sensitive part of this with two stories about various different experiences I've had, which illustrate some of the issues I've spoken to already. And those who can focus on specifically in the rest of the time that I have. The first is a story of what I perceive at the time to be a story of failure, my failure, to get people to talk to me about their lives. It took place when I was beginning this research on the anarchist collectives, and I had discovered by Luke in an archive, a series of minutes and pretty much a full set of records from a particular agricultural collective that had existed in the town of Florida outside of Barcelona. And I was tremendously excited by this data and wanted to go back to the town to see if it was in our city, to see if there were people there who had many people from the town left and were refugees in the very world, and one of the places where they come. And very few people who lived in there that were told before continued to live there through the time. This was in 1971. But there were still some people left, and there were people there from, there was a newly reformed anarchist union office. And I had some younger anarchist friends who were supposed to help me with my contact with all the people. I did find some of the contemporary names appeared in the archival records, and I was amazingly excited about farming. And this was 2 or 3 years after, 3 years after my daughter died. That are expecting people to be very leaping at a chance to talk about their stories, which they are not going to show people in this training process. Franco was telling a story about this tremendous social revolution that changed their lives. And what I found for most of these people was shut doors and a tremendous amount of finally realized that all these people were trying to tell me something, that I hadn't come there to learn. Then he said things like, it was a long time ago, why don't you just let that be? Lots of times the wives of people who had been involved in what they said, he was young and he didn't know any better, he just knew what he was told, and said, shut the door. One of the four founders of the club, my group, was still alive and was living in the town, closed the door. And closed the door, he made it on the older anarchist who had known him from that period, who knew him from the still, who, after some of the work, I had not been in his place to think of that, but he closed the door. And what I learned from that was, on the one hand, something about little bits and pieces of what happened in the Civil War, but mainly what I learned was the impact of 40 years of repression on people, and the fact that fear does not go away, and when we did say that God has particularly done a lot of these people who are very important in power. So that was what I learned from that, was much more about those 40 years than I had about the period of the Reformation. But it raised, as this was going on, a whole series of questions for me. Did I have a right even to try to find out what happened to these people? Once I realized that what I was meeting up with was here, then I started to think, what right do I have to even ask about this? Because that was bringing up so much fear for them that they had spent 40 years to get closed off. Can we, as researchers, go and ask people to tell or to claim the story that they no longer want to claim as their own? And that led me off into a whole other direction that I mentioned, trying to go. I think it's the other side of what participating in social revolution and when it comes to public pressure can do. Well, I guess there are a number of different possibilities. I think in this particular case, what happened, well, I had a whole lot of ideas about why this group of people didn't want to share. And a lot of it, I think, does have to be more. Some of it probably has to be that they didn't, they also didn't want to share it with this older man who from there. These people, many of them had been anarchists in the war period, but had totally lost any connection with the movement and the community leaders. There was an area where the repression had been particularly severe, and those people who experienced it as individuals, they felt really, really isolated and humiliated. I did not get that response from people that I dealt with elsewhere. And from people that I came to through the movement, because they were people who still had connections with me. And that became, I ended up writing a whole thing about that. But I think with the isolation in the face of the depression, which is what we were. And the other piece of it, I think, was that as this older man was pointing out to me, many of these people after the war became, they went into exile, became necessarily become normal children, whether they were in Brazil or France or wherever they had gone into exile. And the children had managed to make it in the world from really good ones here about all that other stuff. Either if they were living in Spain, they couldn't tell the children that. But even the ones who were not living in Spain, often the children didn't want to hear it. And so they were denied their own history. And I think for some of them, they were denied that history for themselves. And there's only so long we can go without being able to tell your story until you lose it in the story. Or what becomes the most powerful presence is the recognition that you can't tell it. And you almost forget what it is that you can't tell it. It was a very dramatic way of learning that. Although my immediate reaction was that there was no money to go to me. And I still wonder about that. I think it had much to do with her story was in many ways representative, not typical, of the various things that I interviewed in France. She was someone who grew up in a rural area outside of, actually, very near where we grew up, in a little village, very conservative area. Her father was a school teacher who taught her to read. He died when she was 10. And when she was 14, she moved to Barcelona on her own, with her uncle, to escape having to marry. And she said, I didn't want to spend my life inside a building, a house. So she moved to Barcelona, got a series of jobs, eventually got involved with the union, got involved with anarchist organizations, worked on schools, and became a militant community. And describing her life, she said, it was an incredible life, a life dedicated to militant, a life dedicated to struggle, to knowledge, to the working society, is characterized by a kind of effervescent conservatism. And when she spoke, and many of the other people spoke, it was exactly the opposite of the kind of response that people were ready to. It was this tremendous excitement and desire to share what they had done, what they had gone through. And to let that story be known. We talked for quite a number of hours over the course of a few days about her story, about how she had grown up, how she had evolved in the movement, and what difference that made in her life. She was really becoming a different person. She was continuing to grow up in her village. And the thing I want to mention here, which is crucial to what follows next, is that in her case, and in the case of virtually all the other people that I met, particularly people that I met through the movement, my political commitments were crucial to being able to do this work. They needed to, they asked, where I stood on the issue. And there was a sense of a bond between us in terms of the movement producing political goals, which is what gave me access to that. Had I not had that, and so we shared something to tell her about what was going on in the United States and what she told me what was going on in Spain and what was good.
Did you tell the movie?
But this one is solely about the story. Actually, I have two pictures of something to think about. I took the one with me and I can show them all. Anyway, so both the connections that we had with one another and the differences between our lives, of course, became very clear through this process. And two things that she said to me during the course, well, one thing she said to me and one thing I didn't say to her, made very clear what those differences were, and again, brought up some of the difficulties in doing this kind of work. One was she was discussing her role at the barricades in response to the general what they did and how she was wanted to run off with the men rather than stay with the women in the place because she was very interested, although she had a gun and she was very weak, she was very using guns. But she showed me, she said there was a lot of fighting and a lot of that, and she showed me the scars that she had on her when she was raised by bullets in the demonstration. And she said, did that ever happen to you? The illustrations that you put involved in the same thing I thought, we're in a different world here. And I could talk about how I came with that and this is a sense of tear gas. I said that's very different from the stuff I've bullet. Do what you can in our that sense of the difference between our lives was very dramatic. The other piece of that, I think, which again caught me up toward in a different direction, was that this was now by maybe the third or fourth day that I was talking with her, and we talked a lot about various parts of her life that she'd been doing, and it became clear that she had never married, and she was one of the very few people, one of the very few women that I met, who had never married. And at the time that I realized that, I wanted to ask her who thing I asked Mr. Baden why he gave some comments about how clubs like to be free to be involved with lots of different people instead of focusing on one. But I wanted to push her more on that, and I realized that I couldn't, because I had somehow or other passed over the bound between from being an interviewer, and I now felt that we were somehow friends. But I didn't know her well enough as a friend to ask that kind of a question. So I couldn't do the work in a way that I had thought I had come here to do. I couldn't ask the question of her or a series of questions that I might have asked her had I had the distance that I had initially come there. But the loss of that distance that made me get a lot of the material that I got, it also meant that there were limits to what I could ask. Well, what I felt like that, I don't know how to respond to that, but it was a very interesting thing to realize the process that I suspect that I was the other one, I don't know how people do that. Anyway, so that raised for me that whole series of questions about why am I studying these people in the events? For whom am I writing? Whose story am I telling? I conducted, as I mentioned, I conducted the press conference that was in some point this winter, spring, going through the summer of 1979, and I couldn't get back to Spain again until the summer of 1981. I did go back. And I wondered, I think we'll get back to the middle of July, about 6 weeks before the end of the summer. It's a crazy time to go to Spain. People in Europe go on vacation for a lot. Nobody's there. I got there and couldn't reach anybody. And I thought to myself, why would you do this? Why did you come there? It doesn't really make any sense in a rational point of view. And I realized I had felt compelled to go back to Spain. Recently, my entire career, I knew that I had to go there, I had to try to find new people. And what I discovered while I was there, that I was going back there for me, as much as to get more data and information, because they had become, both the people that I was interviewing and the people I had met through this process, you know, my generation, they had become my interpretive community. They were the people, as opposed to my many of my scholarly colleagues, Jackie Smith, who recognized that I had an interest in what their lives had been about beyond simply filling in blanks of historical data. But somehow or another, those political commitments which I shared with them were crucial to the work that I was doing and to why I was doing it there. And they could understand that. But very few of my scholarly colleagues here, even the people that I knew at that time, were particularly interested in hearing that, or were trying to figure out to validate that in any way. But it's clear to me that it was only through my feeling that I'm acting on that I was able to tell the story the way I thought it was to be told. And to realize then that I'm doing this work and trying to tell these stories both for them and for us. For them, because the social revolution as a whole has been unfortunately lost in the consciousness of many people who think the story that needs to be told, and in particular the role of organizations like the 23,000 members in the basis of the Second Nation. Quite a large number, largely deliberate. So that their stories will not continue to be lost amidst the complicated political machinations of the Spanish Civil War. But I'm also writing for us, and by that us I mean feminists, contemporary feminists in the United States, and leftists more generally, people interested in social change, and particularly in consciousness change, because I think they have some very important things to tell us about that process. There are two aspects of their vision and what they're doing with their lives which I think are particularly important to us. One has to do with the process of empowerment and one has to do with direct action and institution. They saw and they acted really on empowerment as the focus of any meaningful vision empowerment coming from and through communities of people, support networks, cultural work. They saw their literacy campaigns, they did a lot of literacy work, which Matt, which when I was talking to him, was about sort of like what Fidel Castro was doing in Nicaragua. We did that 40 years ago. Recognizing that people feel disempowered by their inability to read and send information, and that's the first step for doing allowing people to become active and involved in community without them taking that information on their own terms. And they do literacy work to help people to become understanding and engaged in the people of the day. Health and sexuality workshops, child information about childcare, how to set up daycare, arrangements of apprenticeship, empowerment at the workplace. They have little groups for women to meet before union meetings so that women can get used to hearing the sound of their voices in public and they used to feel shy when they have to go into a mixed group of men and women and make sure that they keep up their own agenda. All of these things, they're modern in America. It was all due to this focus. Their word was to up that film. To let people get in touch with their own capacity, empowerment, we had to that. That was the purpose of their organization. And they also had, coming again out of the anarchist movement commitment, a focus on direct action and participation, a recognition that empowerment, consciousness raising, consciousness change comes from taking part in creating new society. We make things other than the way they are by making them other than the way by doing what we think we know. And a real commitment to a consistency of new things, which characterize the anarchist movement in general and these other cities in particular. The more I see not just that these things worked as strategies for change, and these things work for them and started to change, and we can learn from them, but the more I look at that, the more I realize that is what we are doing as well. This is our story as well as their story. This is what, in large part, the contemporary feminist movement is about in the United States. That kind of empowerment, consciousness-raising groups, women's health collectives, whatever it is that needs the Pentagon action, the anti-nuclear demonstrating, it's all direct action, it's all designed to get women in touch with our own power to do things, taking power and doing things differently than what's been done, telling new stories in our words. And I've come to see that in learning and telling their story, I can better see our story and talk to other people about what it is we are doing in light of that, which runs the danger, I suppose, of contaminating the data, reading back too much of our story into their story. And that's something that becomes one of these ongoing dilemmas, I guess, for the researcher. But I think it also points out, it certainly pointed out to me, the significance of the feminist community to the reports of community, and to recognize among ourselves that we know and which they emphasize as well, that community is an important part of the component. But the other piece, I think, is the community that builds across generations, across historical contexts, and across movements by recognizing that there is a larger process, in a sense, of which we are all a part in these different places, and which can empower us within community.
Okay. this is going to be, particularly the first half, somewhat of a point to try to get drawn to many of the issues that Martha has drawn out. I am drawing ultimately on two different kinds of field experiences. I am an anthropologist, not a historian. It probably will become clear as I get into my discussion here. And very much reflect the kind of questions I'm asking. You will not learn very much, though, about the field. I can't get into that detail, into any detail, and perhaps I can mistake why I do it, but I wanted to, So let me raise on, and if you have questions later, you can ask them on that. There is little need, or so it would seem, to discuss the interest feminist scholars in Africa have in oral history, especially in a group like this. From the earliest days of the contemporary women's movement, feminists have claimed that his story was not her story. Books and articles abound with titles like In Her Own Voice. We have archives together women's impressions, creative expressions, and experiences. To the question posed by this workshop, who's telling whose story and why, the answer is obvious. Women are telling their, our story, because they, we, have not been heard from before. And there are many different stories from different kinds of women. Working class women, middle class women, women of color, white women, women from other countries, from remote and exotic cultures, lesbian, bisexual, and heterosexual women. Almost nobody challenges the effort that is given. And we feminists are hardly alone. With the recognition social history has gained among scholars of history, oral history has established itself as a respectable field, a legitimate way to record the lives of ordinary people who have come to figure so prominently in this new sociological approach to the discipline. Still, oral history has been an object of severe criticism. Some, if so it appears, have lost patience with the day-by-day ramblings of courageous unknown people. We tend to prefer more focused analogies. Take the case of Joan Keeler, the union organizer and wife of a Bolivian miner, who tells her story in She Makes That Movement of Love, translated Let Me Speak. While the book was enthusiastically received in the mid-1970s, today people still interested in the subject probably look to the anthropologist being met to explain the historical and social problems that have plagued Bolivian miners for centuries. We no longer bother with Joan Keeler, and I might add, have let her disappear once again into oblivion. First we, and when I say we, I mean the we of the women in labor movement, brought out her story in Spanish, English, and many other languages. Did Joan Keeler make any money from the royalties? Then we featured her in the film The Double Day and invited her to Mexico City for the UN conference on women. But since, well, we have moved on to other problems, other approaches to Joan Keeler's problems, and she, the labor movement, not her, has continued to, not us, has continued to support her. Why this change of thought? Are we joining the conservative turn in politics and scholarship, silencing again the voices our movement claims to represent? Perhaps. Certainly, Joan Keeler's experience suggests this. There is, however, a related question. Are oral histories truly representative of other voices, or are they edited inventions made to fit an agenda, political, personal, and intellectual? When we let Joan Keeler speak a few years ago, did we know how to listen? Did we want to listen, or were we looking instead to create a version of her story that would support our views? Many of us involved in gathering oral histories have been concerned about the exercise for a number of years. Among the most important attempts in recent months to open up the subject is Joan Ingelheim's self-criticism presented at the Birth last June. Her paper, and I might add she's here, so if you can join in the discussion later, Women and the Holocaust, a Reconsideration of Research, will be published in Science. Is it the spring? When is it coming out? The summer, okay, volume 1031. In this piece, Joan challenges her own undertaking of collecting the stories of women who survived the Holocaust. As she was seeking to find special or different strengths of women to identify the way they were able to give support and sustenance to one another during this monstrous campaign of genocide, Joan began to question the political implications of the project. Without realizing it, cultural feminism, which she now seems to reject, led her to make some troubling assumptions. Quote, I seem to be saying that in spite of rape, abuse, the murder of babies, in spite of starvation, separation, losses, terror, violence, in spite of everything ugly and disgusting, women bonded, loved each other. But the bonding was limited and exclusive. It wasn't the bonding against the enemy of solidarity with women. Did the terror of isolation and death not affect the women because they bonded? Perhaps these friendship stories cover a deeper and more troubled story of intrigue, bitterness, hurt, pain, and brutality. What else happened in the groups? Between the groups? The talk about friendship allowed those of us who heard the stories to admire these women, even to receive some peace and comfort. It helped lessen the terror of the surrounding sounds of the Holocaust. This, quote, woman-centered perspective and the questions it addressed were inspiring. End of quote. John then suggested a set of questions which will help us, quote, break down the dangerous alliance between trying to understand oppression and needing to mythologize our strengths in oppression.